It is August 1933, and a young lady called Violet has journeyed to the Tietvaal Memorial on a deeply personal pilgrimage. She bought a postcard with a photograph of the memorial taken from the back, showing the French graves and the memorial in all its glory, towering over the Somme battlefield. And on the postcard, she sent it to her sister, Ethel. And she wrote these few words. She said, "This is the memorial at Tietvaal to the ones who were never found. It is beautiful, and Noel's name is engraved on it." Incredible to us to think now that that memorial had only been open a year. And who was Violet? Who was the boy that she'd come to see, whose name is on the memorial? Well, like all of those 72,000 men that are remembered on Tietvaal, he had a life before the war. He had hopes and ambitions for when he returned to civilian life after Britain had vanquished Germany from France and Belgium. But like all the others, he never got to fulfil those ambitions, but he did leave a big imprint on this world from his sporting achievements before the war. His name was Lancelot Andrew Noel Slocock, known as Noel because he was born on Christmas Day, and he died at Guillemont on the 9th of August 1916. And what makes him famous? It was because he was an England rugby international. He played 8 matches for England. He was cap number 443. And in one of those matches, he was the captain. His first match was in January of 1907. A win over France. He scored 1 try. He scored another try in a loss against Ireland in Dublin the following month. And in his last match, which he captained against the old enemy, the Scots, England lost 16-10, but he scored a try in that game as well. After he died, the words that I'm going to read to you now are one of the many tributes about Noel. It says he was a giant in stature with large limbs and hands to make his figure the symmetrical and beautiful thing it was. He was of that type which we, who knew him, knew instinctively when he went to war that we should not meet again on earth. There are many such in this noble role, and amongst the greatest of them there is no doubt that Noel Slocock holds a high place. He leaves one boy, Anthony, who is the exact likeness of his father. That this fine specimen of young, fresh England may grow up to be as good a man and sportsman as his splendid father will be the wish of all who remember Noel Slocock at play or at work. He has an example not given to all youngsters, for his sire was a man among men. So welcome to another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And this week, the episode is not just about Noel, but another man who had played rugby for England. And his name was Jack King. Now, Noel was a junior officer, a second lieutenant, but Jack wasn't. And he also played rugby for England. He played 12 matches, not at the same time as Noel, but he played between 1911 and 1913. And Lance Corporal John Abbott King was also to be killed alongside his good friend Noel on the 9th of August 1916. Neither of these boys have a known grave, and they're both remembered on the Tietvaal Memorial. This is their story this week. So what brought my attention to these two boys? Well, I'm indebted to a man called Toby Goodman, who listens to the podcast. He contacted me to say that he'd written a limited edition book. There's only 100 copies, which he called Jack and Noel From Scrum to Sacrifice. He says on the front cover there's a rugby ball surrounded by poppies, and it says that rugby shaped them, war defined them, the untold story of Jack King and Noel Slocock. And inside, Toby's signed the book for me. It's his limited edition. It's number 97 out of 110. And inside the front cover, the well-known artist and historian Tim Godden has drawn a beautiful picture of the two boys climbing out of the trench together, carrying their Lee Enfield rifles, arm in arm. So what made Toby so interested in these two boys? Well, he explains in the book, he says 10 years ago, he was sitting on a minibus rolling through northern France, accompanied a group of school parents on a visit to the World War I battlefields. And as they approached the scarred, or what was then the scarred earth of Guillemont, one of the parents, a former England rugby captain, shared a story with me that left a long-lasting impression, says Toby. He said that England rugby captain spoke of two British soldiers who'd been killed in action in this very region a century earlier. Both had played rugby for England and one even captained the national team. And Toby says, as he spoke, I vividly pictured those two young men, allies in peace, brothers in combat, because they played for opposing teams, rising from the trench together, ready to face the opposition. Not on a pitch this time, but on the fields of war. And it conjured up a powerful image, one of courage, loyalty and leadership under fire. And it has stayed with me ever since, says Toby. I turned to the parents and asked if he had been in their place, who he would have gone over the top with. Lewis Moody was that parent, and he didn't hesitate. Jono, he said, referring to Martin Johnson, his captain, during that legendary 2003 Rugby World Cup campaign, in which England famously beat Australia. Moody said that Jono was a great leader. He always led by example. I would have followed him anywhere, even into battle. In that moment, something became clear in my mind, says Toby. True leadership isn't about titles or trophies. It's about trust. It's about the people who inspire us to stand tall, even when the world is at its darkest and we are being pushed to the limits of our endurance. Toby says that this book is a tribute to John Jack Abbott King and Lancelot Andrew Noel Slocock, and it is dedicated to his friend Lewis Walton Moody, MBE. So I want to tell their story this week, and I'm going to use Toby's book to help me tell the story. And as we'll see later on, that wasn't the end of it. Because a few days ago, I ventured down to Twickenham, where Toby had arranged a reunion of the descendants of those two lads, where they enjoyed afternoon tea in one of the hospitality lounges at Twickenham. And then I joined them on a tour of the stadium, and they shared with me their thoughts of the relatives that they never met, but have such a strong connection with. That comes up later on, but let's first of all find out who Jack and Noel were. Well, Jack was born in Leeds in August of 1883, but when he was just 10 years old, his father died of pneumonia, leaving his mum, Mary, a widow with six children to raise. And just 3 years later, the six children became orphans when Mary succumbed to breast cancer in 1896. The eldest sister, Emily, she took on the role of head of the household. But for Jack, he was to leave the family because they decided he needed a quality education. And he was sent off in 1898 to Giggleswick School, a free independent school in North Yorkshire. And then he left school, and by 1901, alongside two other Englishmen, he became a farming student. And in 1903, he moved out to South Africa to continue his training. But by this time, he'd already become an enthusiastic and passionate rugby player. And he played for two clubs near Cape Town. He was only 5'5" tall, but he had a powerful physique, including a 45-inch chest. And it was during these years abroad that he truly honed the strength and determination that characterised his rugby playing style. He came back to Yorkshire in 1905 and continued his agricultural pursuits. And he bought a farm in Ilkley. And he settled there with his siblings. He established a dairy enterprise supplying milk locally whilst cultivating the arable farmland. But it wasn't farming, of course, Harry made his name. It was rugby union. He joined the respected Headingley Club. And within a year, he was selected to represent Yorkshire. By the 1907-08 season, he'd become a regular in the county side. And he remained a regular until the outbreak of war. And between 1911 and 1913, he captained the county of Yorkshire. His brother, Arthur, also played and captained Yorkshire, and Jack and Arthur, between them, they developed their skills through a unique training method at their family farm. They draw a large circle on the barn door and spend countless hours throwing a rugby ball at it, catching it on the rebound at full speed and from multiple angles. And this drill helped them perfect the art of passing and receiving the ball under pressure from any position. And it was in 1911 that Jack made his international debut for England against Wales in Swansea. He became a regular in the side, played in every international match through to the end of the 1913 season, with one exception. He missed the final fixture of the 1912 campaign, but he returned for the Five Nations Championship the following year, and Jack became part of the first England team to achieve what was called the Grand Slam. A passage in the Scottish Referee newspaper following the final match highlighted his ability and his importance to the team. The article said, "Of all the mighty men who did duty for England at Twickenham on Saturday, not one proved a greater service to the side than the little Headingley forward. For his inches, King is an absolute marvel, and we should say that he is the best staying forward playing the game at the present moment. His work in the scrummage was marked by resolution and power, while he had no superior in the open, and his tackling left nothing to be desired. King is one of the greatest assets England possesses, and his place in the English side looks a certainty for some years if he escapes accident." But then August 1914 comes around, war is declared, nothing will ever be the same again. The Rugby Football Union tried to carry on with the new season as usual. But players across the country enlisted in their droves, answering the national call with the same commitment they'd once shown on the pitch. And on the last day of August 1914, the Yorkshire Rugby Union formally recognised the reality of the moment, and at their committee meeting, they decided that all rugby in the county would be suspended for the duration of the conflict. And they issued an appeal for players to join up and serve their country. But for Jack, he'd already done that. Jack had a teammate and a close friend known as Tom Busty Lum. Lum was a territorial officer, and he received his mobilisation orders while the two men were out in the fields, haymaking under the summer sun. And seeing his mate called to arms, it spurred Jack into action. There was no delay. He told his sisters, issued instructions for managing the farm in his absence, and he made his way to the headquarters of the Yorkshire Hussars. But he was told he was 1 inch below the minimum height requirement of 5'6". His application was declined. He was stunned, but of course he wasn't going to be deterred, was he? His perseverance proved successful. He enlisted on the 12th of August 1914. He stood up and he told the recruiting sergeant, "Well, I've come purposely through here to join the same regiment as my friend Lum, and I'm simply going to stick here until you do take me in." Tragically, his friend, Busty Lum, was killed at Ypres in May 1915. Jack had become frustrated riding a horse in the Yorkshire Hussars. He wrote a letter to a friend at home. He said he wanted to be more of a soldier and he wanted to transfer to an infantry regiment. The death of his mate made him even more determined. And a chance encounter with a former rugby rival, Noel Slocock, eventually opened the door for Jack to transfer to a different regiment. And in doing so, his fate was sealed. So who was Noel? Well, he was born in a small Warwickshire village in 1886. And although, as I said earlier, he was christened Lancelot Andrew Noel Slocock because he was born on Christmas Day, his father, who was the Reverend, agreed that he would be known as Noel. By 1900, the family had relocated to Hampshire because his father had been sent there as a rector. And Noel began his formal education at Marlborough College. He went there from September 1900 to July 1904. And whilst at that school, he quickly distinguished himself as a talented all-round sportsman. He's one of those annoying characters that's good at more than one thing. He played for the football 11, the cricket 11, and also the hockey 11. He captained the school's rugby 15 in 1903. And in the college magazine, it said for his age, he is extraordinarily big and strong and would increase knowledge of the game, should make an exceedingly good forward next year. In the cricket team, he was batting in the top order and was an accurate slow spin bowler. One review said, a better bat on a slow wicket than on a fast wicket because he cannot play forward except with a crooked bat. But even then, he was worth a good many more runs than he made. When set, he was a very punishing bat, especially on the offside. A slow, good length, simple bowler, an excellent field and a very safe catch. When he completed his education, he went up to Liverpool and he took up a position in the cotton merchants, Watson & Co. And he joined one of the country's oldest rugby union teams, Liverpool Football Club. And of course, he also joined the cricket club in Liverpool. And he made his county rugby debut in 1905 in a match against Cheshire. And in the following year, he lined up in the War of the Rival Roses match against Yorkshire. And that was when he first played against Jack King. Lancashire won 16-6. And a month later, in December 1906, Noel was selected for the North v South International Trial. And he was, after a good performance, supposed to earn selection for England. It was a clerical error, would you believe? He was omitted from the final squad, but he was undeterred, of course. He would be, wouldn't he? He faced the South Africans in Manchester as part of the Lancashire side. He made a strong case for higher honours, scored a try. The man that got his place in the team because of that clerical error, Alcock, he didn't perform that well in the international outing. He never played for England again. But he did become a doctor and serve for many years as the medic for Gloucester Rugby Football Club. So Noel earned his international debut for England in January of 1907. They played France in Richmond in Surrey. It was the first time France had played on English soil, and England won 41-13 with Noel celebrating his debut, as I said earlier, by scoring a try. In another game, in 1908, he received this review. It says, Slocock, the only Lancashire man on the team, was much the best forward on the ground, and so enamoured of his play was one spectator that he very kindly sent us the following telegram. He says, Slocock played a wonderful game, always there and almost unstoppable. Simply brilliant. Bravo, Lancashire. The final match of the season against Scotland, Noel suffered a knee injury and it effectively finished his rugby career. And he married Lena in 1912. And his business career continued to flourish. Although he couldn't play rugby anymore, he could still play cricket. And in one match at Cheltenham in May 1913, he scored 105. In February of 1914, Noel and Lena welcomed Anthony, known as Tony Slocock, their son, into their family. But his successful business career had taken him across the Atlantic. He was working in Savannah, in the state of Georgia, working as a cotton buyer. And he wasn't there when his son was born. But he wrote this letter home. He said, it's a glorious feeling to know one has a child of one's very own, and I'm now living to get back to see them. I have been kept well posted as to my two beloved's well-being, and Lena wrote me a long letter last week. She seems to have been wonderfully well all through. I expect this letter will get you about the same time as I arrive, as you can think of me spending what I know will be the happiest and proudest day of my life so far. I often wonder whether anybody could be as happy and blessed by matrimony as I have been. Of course, Noel felt a strong sense of duty to both king and country, and in 1915 he came back from America and immediately enlisted in the British Army. On October the 1st, 1915, he became a second lieutenant and assigned to the King's Liverpool Regiment, a territorial unit known as the Liverpool Scottish. He was trained at a camp near Blackpool and deployed to France on the 9th of January 1916. Not long after he arrived in France, he he was transferred to the 1st 10th Battalion, which was part of the 55th West Lancashire Division. Now, within a few weeks of arriving in France, Noel came across Jack King whilst they were stationed in an area near Arras. And Noel apparently encouraged Jack, who, as we know, wanted to see more active service, to transfer to the Liverpool Scottish. And Jack's transfer was approved on the 14th of February 1916, and he was posted to Noel's unit. The unit remained in the Arras area for the next few months, and Noel wrote letters home, and in one letter to his father-in-law, he said this: "I've been kept very fit and well, and if life is monotonous, it is at least healthy. We left our old spot in the line after being there for 5 months, and after a week in a very warm village elsewhere, we are now well behind the front line, enjoying a few quiet days before the more serious part for us commences. From what I can hear, we were off for the south in a few days, and you of course know what that means. We are all very cheery and glad that we are again to have a go at close quarters. I of course have not told Lena, and I think it is better not to, as it would worry her and do no good. But I know that whatever happens to me, she and Tony will always have a good home with you, and that is a very comforting thought. Altogether, things look brighter for our side than at any previous time, and I hope another 6 months will see the worst over." Of course, we now know that's not the case. A few weeks later, on the 4th of August 1916, he is now on the Somme battlefield. It's a few days before they go over the top in that terrible area of the Somme at Gouillemont. And he wrote his final letter home, this time to his mother. His mood is somewhat different. He says, "Two out of three officers who came to see us one night were killed the next morning. And what I've seen of this place, it is not conducive to long life and happiness. It is almost impossible to begin to describe the sights and sounds here. They baffle description. And had I not seen them, could never have believed such chaos could be created by man. The whole place is a veritable shambles, and this excessive heat and dust doesn't add to the gaiety of nations. No one here seems to know what is happening, but from all accounts, the Germans must have had an awful time of it, and they seem more demoralised and ready to surrender at any previous time in the war. Our artillery never stop firing day and night, and if they can keep it up, we ought to go through in time. We are in support trenches here at present, but expect to move up to the front any time now." Meanwhile, his mate Jack King, he wrote home to a family friend, Bob Oakes. He said, "I'm absolutely A1 in every way, but one can never tell, and so long as I don't disgrace the old rugby game, I don't think I mind." Gouillemont. I've done a podcast in the early days, must be 3, maybe 4 years ago now. If you go back in the catalogue, you'll find it. I think we talked about the Northamptonshire Regiment. That was in September. This is a month before that. And the German writer Ernst Junger, he of course was there. He wrote in his famous book, Storm of Steel. He said, "When morning paled, the strange surroundings gradually revealed themselves to our unbelieving eyes. The defile proved to be little more than a series of enormous craters full of pieces of uniform, weapons and dead bodies. In the country around, so far as the eye could see, had been completely ploughed by heavy shells. Not a single blade of grass showed itself. The churned-up field was gruesome. The village of Gouillemont seemed to have disappeared without trace. Just a whitish stain on a cratered field indicated where one of the limestone houses had been pulverised." And this was the battlefield that Jack and Noel were about to enter. They'd spent the 8th of August in reserve. But in that afternoon, it became clear that while the attack on the right had gained ground, the centre and the left flanks were in disarray. And therefore, their battalion was called forward at short notice. The Liverpool Scottish were to attack at 4:20 a.m. Their approach during the night was plagued by confusion and misfortune. There were no guides to lead them to the frontline trenches. They waited for replacements, and when guides eventually came, they only had a vague knowledge of the route up. The men reached their positions with minutes to spare before the assault began. At 0 hour, the bombardment erupted. The Germans counter-barraged, and their barrage was devastatingly accurate. It rained down on both the support trenches and no man's land. As the men advanced into the chaos, they were met by a storm of machine gun fire that pinned them down before they could gain any ground at all. Casualties mounted rapidly, and any ground that they did gain came at a terrible cost. Despite the confusion and the relentless enemy fire and the growing toll on the Liverpool Scottish, that was commanded by a Lieutenant Colonel Davidson, they launched 4 determined charges. Each time the men rallied, it says, with discipline and courage, and each time they were driven back by the overwhelming force. There was a Colonel McGilchrist, he wrote, "What of the condition of the men? They'd been on the move from 8 p.m. until 3:45 a.m, heavily shelled for a great part of the time, and with no chance whatever of getting any rest. That they were able to attack at all when the signal was given was creditable. That they should rally and go in again and again when nearly all their officers were down was magnificent and showed the stuff the battalion was made of." Now that day, the Liverpool Scottish went in to attack with 20 officers and approximately 600 men of the other ranks, so they were nowhere near full strength. The cost was devastating. By the end of the day, 5 officers had been killed, 5 more were missing, and 7 wounded. And amongst the other ranks, 69 were known to be killed, and of the 27 reported missing, and 167 wounded. Jack and Noel were amongst those that had been reported as missing in action. Now, being very well known as well as loved by their families, news of them being missing quickly made headlines. Lieutenant Colonel Davidson wrote a letter to Noel's wife, Lena. He himself had been wounded and he was in a hospital in Manchester. He said this, "I'm dreadfully sorry to see that your husband is down as missing. The last I saw of him was at 4 a.m. on the morning of the 9th, just before we went over the top. Later, I saw his platoon Sergeant Ferguson, who told me he was hit very early on, and he gave instructions to carry on. I couldn't get any further details, but I understand that Slocock had not been badly hit and had hopes of meeting him further down the line. It's my greatest hope that he will turn up somewhere. Since the short time we were together taught me to admire him greatly. I know what a fine officer and leader he made." The Yorkshire Post newspaper reported, "Jack King officially reported missing. Fears for the safety of King, the well-known international forward, have been privately held for the last 2 or 3 weeks, and they will be accentuated by the official announcement that he's missing. Jack King, as he was familiarly called, was one of the most popular forwards in the ranks of Headingley Rugby Union Club, the Yorkshire County team, and the England International 15s of recent years." Lieutenant Colonel Davidson wrote another letter, this time to Jack's sisters. He said, "When I saw him absolutely cool and collected under murderous machine gun fire, with shells falling all around, one thanked God for such a man to set such a priceless example. He was absolutely lion-hearted, and had he come through, I should have promoted him on the field and recommended him for the Distinguished Conduct Medal. It was a sad day for football. We can ill spare men like these. But if another game of football is never played in Britain, the game has done well. For after 2 years' command in the field, I'm convinced that the rugby footballer makes the finest soldier in the world." We can only imagine the scenes in the homes of these two lads, repeated, of course, up and down the country, of suspecting that their loved ones were dead, hoping that one day they'd be found, maybe in a hospital or a prisoner of war camp, and one day return home, perhaps. But they were false hopes. On the 21st of February 1917, Noel's death was officially recognised by the Army Council, and many more obituaries appeared in the newspapers in Yorkshire and beyond. One of Noel's old school friends wrote a letter to Lena, and it was published in the Times. He said, "We always admired him at school because he was so straight and fearless and kind-hearted, and we always knew If we followed his example, we would be doing right. His wonderful prowess in games is known to all. But there is another side of his life there which may not be known to you and which I should like to mention. When I went to Marlborough in 1899, our house was notorious as a centre of bullying. I determined then, if ever I could, to put a stop to this hideous system. But it was your son who accomplished what I'd only helped to do. Practically unaided and in the face of powerful opposition, he was so successful that when I left in 1903, he'd made the house an example to the rest of the school, intellectually, mentally and physically. Tragically, 2 years later, Noel's brother, Cyprian Henry Slocock, had died of wounds in France, and there was a memorial service held at St Luke's Church in Maidenhead on the 11th of May 1918 to honour both brothers. It was a large gathering of friends and family. Noel's mother was there, of course, Lena, and their son Tony, who was now 4 years old. The service concluded with the singing of Tennyson's Crossing the Bar and the first verse of the national anthem. This is that poem, Crossing the Bar.
Sunset and evening star, and one clear call for me. And may there be no moaning of the bar when I put out to sea. But such a tide as moving seems asleep, too full for sound and foam, when that which drew from out the boundless deep turns again home. Twilight and evening bell, and after that the dark. And may there be no sadness of farewell when I embark. For though from out our bourne of time and place the flood may bear me far, I hope to see my pilot face to face when I have crossed the bar.
In his book about Jack and Noel, Toby talks about how much the sport of rugby football contributed to the British Army and beyond in the First World War. Toby's a New Zealander, and of course he remembers Dave Gallagher, famous All Black, who captained the 1905 All Blacks. He was a veteran of the Second Boer War. He was killed at Passchendaele at the age of 43. Many of you I know would have visited his grave, Nine Elms Cemetery, close to Poppering. Toby quotes various important people that talked about the influence of rugby football on the army and the Great War. There was a Major General Murchison, former captain of the Rugby School 15. He said both rugby and the armed forces prized courage, loyalty and trust among teammates. The controlled aggression and mental focus honed on the rugby field translates seamlessly to the challenges faced in soldiering. And another senior officer, Lieutenant Colonel Arthur Daw of the Scots Guards, he said soldiers who have played rugby generally embody all the virtues and qualities required for successful combat. These include fearless courage, team spirit, unselfishness, and the will to win. I think you'll agree with that we can see all of those values in both Jack and Noel. 115 internationally capped rugby players lost their lives fighting for the Allied forces in the Great War, and Jack and Noel were living examples of these ideals, displaying them in abundance, both on the rugby field and also on the cricket field and the hockey field, but also, of course, on the battlefields of the Western Front. What came after? What was left behind? Well, Noel's wife Lena was left behind. She did remarry in 1919. She married a man called William Wilson, and they had a daughter together. But Lena died in 1978, decades after the loss of dear Noel. And she was always haunted by his death. And they had a son, of course, Tony. He got married to Elizabeth in 1934, and they had four sons. But do you remember, a couple of years ago, we recorded a podcast with John Nicol about the unknown warrior entombed in Westminster Abbey, And the story, as far as John was concerned, was inspired by the Reverend David Roughton, the military chaplain and the driving force behind the idea of that Tomb of the Unknown Warrior. But one of those four sons that Tony had, and therefore Noel's grandson, married the granddaughter of the Reverend David Roughton. And Tony went on himself to have a distinguished military career in the Second World War. He served, like his father, as a second lieutenant, but this time in the Royal Artillery, and he saw active service in the Middle East. His family members were quoted as saying he was a great encourager of others and seemed able to bring out the best in people. His other qualities included courage, love, enthusiasm, humour, generosity and wisdom. Chip off the old block really, isn't he, Tony? He was a stockbroker by trade. He died in Devon in 1995, aged 81. But on the 10th of November 2018, to mark the centenary of the armistice, Noel's great-great-grandson, Jack, served as a mascot for the England rugby team during their match against New Zealand at Twickenham. And alongside him stood the great-great-nephew of Ronald Poulton Palmer, a former England captain, who fell on the Western Front in May of 1915 and is buried near Ypres. So what became of Jack? Well, he didn't marry, but his surviving siblings were Gertrude, Olive, Alice and Arthur. They remained working on the farm. Jack's three sisters eventually moved to North Yorkshire. Olive married in January of 1920, and Gertrude and Alice went into business together. They ran a tea shop in Settle. Now, Arthur had a son, and he was Jack Abbott's nephew, and he was named John Abbott King in Jack's honour. And he went off to join the armed forces. He joined the RAF, but he too had a tragic death when on the 30th of January 1942, in heavy snowfall in Scotland, his torpedo bomber crashed. The wreckage was not discovered for several days. He was 22 years old. Lena, Noel's wife, her brother, was also killed in the Great War. Lance Corporal Philip Howard Cook died on the 30th of July 1916, and like Noel, he has no known grave and is remembered on the Teepal Memorial. And I mentioned earlier that Noel's brother, Captain Cyprian Slocock, he died of wounds on the 3rd of April 1918 and he's buried at Boulogne Eastern Cemetery. And finally, there was Private Thomas Denison Busty Lamb, as Jack called him, his great mate that inspired him to join up in the first place. As I mentioned, he died during the Second Battle of Ypres, 25th of May 1915. He's another one that doesn't have a grave. He's commemorated on the Menin Gate Memorial in Ypres. So as I mentioned earlier, a few days ago, I went down to Twickenham to meet with the families of the two lads. And I knew that we were going to be given a tour of the museum there at Twickenham and the stadium itself, including the changing rooms. But what I didn't realise was that Lewis Moody himself was going to be joining us. And not only did he join us, but he talked to us about his own rugby career, what it meant to him, and he also talked with such passion about the men that went before him, about the men that not only wore the England rugby jersey, but went from Twickenham to the battlefields of France. Join me now as we wander around Twickenham with the families of Jack and Noel, and also the author of that book, Toby, and Lewis himself. And we began by visiting the memorial to the men that fell in both World Wars that played rugby for England. And Lewis tells us the story of a man that was a South African. This is what he said.
The guy on there who's actually South African, Oscar Schwartz, who was an international South African cricketer, came over here to join the Stock Exchange, ended up playing, I think, two caps for England, and he survived the entire war, enlisted at the start of the war, 1914, survived the entire war. Sometime prior to the end of the war, he must have contracted Spanish flu and died after the war. Yeah.
That man was Reggie, known as Reggie, and he did indeed, as Lewis said, died just a few days after the armistice, on the 18th of November 1918, and he's buried in that enormous cemetery not far from Boulogne at Etaples, or Etaples as the soldiers called it. Not only was he a rugby international for England, but he played cricket, test cricket in fact, for South Africa, his native country. And in 1908 he was named one of the Wisden Cricketers of the Year, and on the battlefield he was awarded the Military Cross in 1916. And then we went out to the main entrance where the players, as Lewis explained to us, come in on the bus, they see all the cheering fans, they go through some gates. And as we hear, these gates had got a very strong connection with both rugby union and the Great War. And the words you'll hear now were spoken by our official guide on the day, whose name was David.
Quite an interesting story. So if you come in a little bit, these gates were designed by an artist called Frank Gray, and they were put here to commemorate the centenary of the First World War. So they were put up in 2015. And lots of symbolism in the gates. So the first piece that you'll see is on the floor here. So as you can see, poppies. 15 of them, obviously representing the 15 in the rugby team. So the poppy, as you know, is the universal, or certainly within the UK and the Commonwealth, symbol of remembrance. It's quite an interesting story as to why it is. You probably know it.
Well, there's all sorts of myths, isn't there?
But yeah.
It's not about blood, is it?
No, it's not about blood. So the first occurrence of it is in a poem by a Canadian doctor who was serving up near the Ypres salient in 1915 in a field hospital, a guy called John McCrae. And he wrote a poem in May 1915 after he'd seen a very close friend killed. And the poem's called In Flanders Fields. You probably know it. In Flanders Fields, the poppies grow amid the crosses, row on row, that mark the place where we lie, and the skylarks sing above. Something like that. I can't quite remember the whole thing, but it's a really well-known, really well-known poem. And in 1918, it was published. And then in 1918, an American academic, a lady called Moika Michaels, strange name, saw the poem and was very much struck by the reference to the poppies. And she thought it would be a great idea to adopt the poppy as an emblem of remembrance. So she lived in New York, and she lived next to a dressmaker, and she asked the dressmaker to make silk poppies, which she then sold to her friends in New York to mark Remembrance Day. And that's how the whole thing started. Actually, so it was in America, not in the UK. She made it her life's work, basically. She died in 1946, and all of that time she was behind the remembrance movements in the States, which was driven by the American Legion, which is the equivalent of the British Legion. Now, you don't really associate Americans with wearing poppies, but apparently they do. It's not a national cultural thing like it is in the UK, but they do wear poppies. But they wear them at a different time of year, so Memorial Day is in May. So that's when they wear those. The idea was also picked up, or her idea, by a French lady who called Anna Guerin, who suggested to Earl Haig, after the First World War had finished, that the poppy could be used as a symbol of remembrance in the UK, and she offered for, I think it was 1 million of them, to be made by ex-French servicemen, disabled servicemen or widows from the First World War, and they were sold in the UK for the first Remembrance Day back in 1921. Great success, and then after that Haig moved production to the UK, where they've been made ever since. So a lot of symbolism here in the poppies. If you come to the gate itself, you see at the base of each gate 15 of these England roses, and each of those roses has 15 petals. You can see the symbolism going on and on, and then as you go up the gate you'll see that the roses gradually transform into poppies.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why these are called the Rose and Poppy Gates.
Well.
At the very top you'll see the poppies look slightly different. They're brass. That's because they're made out of German artillery shell cases, which were fired in 1918, I believe.
Wow.
At the very top. And the last piece, which is interesting, is actually the horizontal bar at the top. That's the height of a trench.
And then Lewis picks up the story of the gates, what it means to him, and then he goes on to talk about, briefly, the experience of entering Twickenham and having contact with the fans.
The opening of the gates when we opened them, but
This was very much about having a public place where all nations, you know, all rugby playing players from all nations could be could be remembered. And the lights at night, there's little strips that glow up red, so they're illuminated red, which is just so for me those used to be solid block walls, so like wooden blocks you couldn't see through and when you come in now, obviously the teams come in here, they don't, in my day we used to stop outside these gates, the gates would be open, this would be lined with the fencing that you see over there, it's a narrow line, whereas the guys now they walk
way
in
back
from the road, which is much more atmospheric, right? You're touching the fans, you're in closer contact. But this is very much the point where you connect with the fan base that you're playing for. Otherwise, until this moment in the stadium, as a player, you are isolated at Pennyhill Park, which is still the base of England rugby, working stuff out on your own as little units, as team. It's only when you drive into Twickenham for the first time, you realise the grandeur of the, you know, the undertaking that you're about to engage in. And it's one of the coolest moments in, you know, as a sportsman, where you get to see how much it means to, where this whole wall of the stadium, all the staircases, people are hanging out of, cheering, chanting. This bit feels like it goes on forever. Obviously, it's probably only, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 people deep. But that's the first point of connection where you start getting really excited about.
Not nervous?
No, well, not for me. I was excited by it. This always brought a smile. Because you're on the bus, you're locked into your headphones, you've got your AirPods on, Henry Pollock's probably got some super relaxed, you know, just chilling out. Yeah, you know, some of Mike Tindall used to be in charge of ours. He had some horrible, like, techno dance nonsense that I tuned out of. And but so when you come off the bus, all of that is about preparing to play. It's staying calm, staying cool. You might be going through the stuff that you want to do on the pitch, you know, first phase calls. But once you get off here, it's the first time you get the real noise and the energy of the fan base. So
But I'd be thinking you haven't even mentioned the opposition. You're not even thinking about the opposition.
No, not at all. No. You're managing yourself. you might be thinking about your role in the game. It's very personal, isn't it? Preparation for anything.
Yeah.
You know, so my personal take on it was focus on yourself, your own involvement, be really clear on your actions, keep it simple.
It's incredible. I keep thinking that we're here because of what happened on the Somme battlefield 110 years ago today.
Extraordinary.
And if you took those two lads to one side that morning and said to them, in 110 years' time, your two families are going to come together and do this,
they wouldn't have gone over the wall.
I think they'd have been honoured.
Yeah.
So last time I was here, I was a mascot.
Really?
To commemorate the 100 years.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yes, it says in the book.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. He was 8.
Yeah.
You were 8. At the top of one of the staircases, deep inside the Twickenham ground, there is an enormous painting called Forever England. And this painting depicts the last England rugby team to play before the outbreak of the Great War. The side, as we know, clinched the Grand Slam by defeating the French in Paris on the 13th of April 1914. 6 of the players identified in the painting by darkened roses on their shirts didn't return from the war. The painting was commissioned by the Rugby Football Union to commemorate the centenary of the First World War, and of course it's dedicated to memory of all rugby players who served and died in the Great War. And we hear a little bit more about this painting and some of the people in it from our guide, David.
And the badges. Now, someone mentioned the grey, the shadow. So those were the players who were basically killed in the First War. So 6 of them. 4 of them in the back row, the captain, Ronnie Poulton, in the middle, and one in the front row down here. So I did a little bit of research here. This is post Slocock's time, but King played with, I think it's 9 of these players. So I think King's last season for England was the 12-13 season. And if you look at that last game which he played in, I think there are 9 of these players who also played in it. So you're looking at very much at his contemporaries.
He came
there.
Close to being in that painting, didn't he?
Absolutely.
He was injured.
Yeah. That's right, yes.
And then Lewis picked up the story of one of those men in the photograph that was awarded the Victoria Cross posthumously.
Which was for going above and beyond the call of duty. So Arthur was killed in Zeebrugge, so he left his ship. He was trying to get his men off the ship to attack a machine gun position on shore. There was a delay in things. He was hit by a shrapnel burst as he was getting off, broke his jaw by all accounts. This is second and third hand information now. And he was last seen leaving the ship, attacking the machine gun post, and he was lost. He became one of the missing, which obviously there are a number on this pitch, but there are really interesting stories, each and every one, just in this picture alone, not including the guys that aren't there. You know, so Cyril Lowe, who's sat at the bottom in the middle, Cyril, arguably one of the youngest players in the picture at this time. He joined the RFC, so the first example of the RAF was the Royal Flying Corps. Bearing in mind, flying had only been in existence, 10, 12, 15 years, something like that. Yeah. He'd been a pretty brave human being to get in anything that looked like a plane to fight in. And so Cyril survived the war. He missed, obviously, 4 years of his rugby playing career due to the war, but still went on to become England's leading try scorer. So he played 23 games, scored 19 tries, which at the time, 23 games. That record stood until 1989.
Our tour guide, David, then gave us some more information about some of the others that were in the painting.
So four on the back row of the field. If you start at the far right there, that's James Watson. So he... born in 1890 in Southsea, studied medicine at Edinburgh, played for Edinburgh Academicals, London Hospital and Blackheath. At the start of the war, he joined the Navy and was actually in the Navy when war broke out. He was torpedoed in October 1914 on HMS Hawk and has no known grave, so the boat sank and couldn't find his body. Arthur Dingle, so he's third from right in the back row, 1891, one of four children. A common theme here, actually, when you look at this place, they all come from huge families, so one of four children. Educated at Durham, then Oxford, played for Richmond, close to here, Roslyn Park, close to here, in Durham County. He was in the East Yorkshire Regiment at the start of the war, and he was killed in Gallipoli.
Right.
No known grave. Pillman, fourth from the left on the back row, born in Kent, 1893, youngest of five children, played for Blackheath and London Counties. Now, he's really interesting. He joined up in 1914 in the Queen's Own Regiment, and like King Anne Slocock, he was killed in the Somme Offensive. So he was killed in the same battle. Just down to the front here, Francis Oakley. He's got an interesting history too. So one of 11 children born in 1891, went into the Navy, so he was in the services at the start of the First World War. He was one of the Navy's earliest submariners. So he was actually killed in December 1914, so a few months after the war started, when his sub was lost in the North Sea. A real submariner pioneer. In the centre, of course, we have Ronnie Poulton, who was the captain. Now, Lewis, you've done a lot about this. Do you want to talk about Ronnie?
Yeah, sure. I mean, David, you've probably got as many interesting facts. So Ronnie was, the Johnny May, Tommy Freeman, the sort of prolific winger and try scorer of his era. He was also he was due to inherit the Hunter and Palmer biscuit dynasty. So it comes from a wealthy stock, yeah. He had records, all sorts of records. So at university, I can always forget, was it Cambridge or Oxford?
Oxford.
Oxford University scored five tries in his last game, which remained a record. He scored in his last game for England, which David just mentioned, which this photo was just before all painting. He scored four tries, which was a record which stood until 2010. I played in a game where his record was equaled. So Ronnie was an out-and-out speedster, evasive, like, creative player. You imagine a lot of his tries were probably scored from distance. But yeah, so Ronnie enlisted, as did, the majority of the England side at this point, and their predecessors, as we know, spoke about most of it, something like 90% had enlisted. The season, the campaign, the sort of domestic campaign season had been halted. He went off to war in 1915, and so in the Roll of Honour, it's got all the sort of information from the people that were around him at the time, and it talks about how they were carrying out menial sort of trench repairs at night. It is suggested that Ronnie believed there was a stalemate between sides, so he could carry on and continue trench repair or look after the injured or dead or whatever. Anyway, he was shot by a sniper. Mm-hmm.
and landed back in the trench where his Batman was the sort of first to attend to him. So he was still alive. And his last words were... So there's mixed accounts. So one says that he was struck under the armpit. Another says that he was struck elsewhere. So anyway, so it's reported that his last words were, "I'll never get to play at Twickenham again," before he passed. And he was only there a couple of months. He played his last game of rugby out the front, behind the lines, found an Irish referee and another international. They organised a game between them.
Because we went to the place where he was shot on the battlefields.
Yeah.
And Anton's farm is still there.
Yeah.
Where the shot was.
You said that so many of these joined up almost immediately.
Yeah.
Rugby was cancelled.
Yeah.
Soccer continued for a while, controversially.
Yeah.
It was a professional game. What do you think the connection is then between international rugby players and the call to serve their nation in the Great War? And what sort of attributes did these guys bring to the army?
I think you sort of feel like you're going into battle as a rugby player anyway. That you approach it, certainly any of the military lads I've spoken to, you approach it with the same training ethos, with the same mentality. So there are a lot of crossovers. You know, the leadership, you know, is not just about an individual, it's about a collective.
Everyone's a leader.
Well, not everyone, but everyone has a responsibility.
Yeah.
As a sort of leader, you know. Okay. You'll have a leadership team. You'll have other people that will lead by example. Those that will lead by decision making. Those that will lead through, you know, the bringing together of the collective. So everyone has a role for sure. But I don't know. I would have joined the army had rugby not gone professional. Mm. That was my career path. And a lot of the lads were similar. And I think, you know, when we train, there's a lot of pre-seasons. You go off with the Marines or the SBS.
Like army-ish.
Yeah, it's very similar. You know, the way you push yourself, the way you train, the physical
disciplines,
the mental ability.
Yeah. Away from family,
bonding.
Yeah, comradeship. Yeah.
Comradeship, you know, that's the word.
A sense of belonging. You know, there's no other place that I've ever experienced where you feel like you go out in front of, you know, a baying crowd and you can put yourself in harm's way for the benefit of your colleagues. And have a genuine impact on the outcome of a game because of that. Mm. So I suppose in some regards, there also lies that.
So those disciplines and skills can be transferred from the fields of the rugby pitch onto the Western Front, can't they? Those.
Arguably so. I mean, there's some great quotes, isn't there?
In the book. Now, in this next section, Lewis takes us down to the changing room and tunnel area at Twickenham, which of course brought back lots of memories for him. And he explained to us the process that he would go through in trying to psych out his opposition players. And it occurred to us all as we spoke that probably Jack and Noel were doing exactly the same thing over 100 years ago. This is what Lewis said.
Laying down a challenge in front of you to say, come on then, you know, and I used to play a game with my opposite number, which was more often than not Richie McCaw during my time playing. So I'd eyeball Richie McCaw and I'd just stare at him until he blinked. And, and as soon as he blinked and looked away, I was like, you know, that's an early win for me. He obviously didn't know the game was afoot, but I went in thinking I already had one up on the board.
I then asked Noel's grandson, Harry, felt when he was first contacted by Lewis and Toby all those years ago. So when it was the centenary then, 10 years ago,
yes.
And Lewis contacted you, did he?
Yes.
Did you know about Noel?
Oh, yes.
You did? You were aware of him?
Well, my father worshipped him.
Right.
And he was the only child.
Yes.
And no real other family other than our daughter and mother.
Yes.
We used to come to Twickenham.
Right.
Most seasons for two or three matches.
Right.
Yeah. He loved it.
Yeah.
And he knew everything about his father.
Right.
It was an absolute tragedy.
Could he remember him?
No, because he was two.
Right. This is often the case, isn't it?
He was two.
Yeah, but he knew of his legacy. And do you think your father had ever been to Gullimont?
I don't think he had.
Yeah.
And I don't think he'd ever been to see his uncle either.
Right.
In Boulogne.
Yes, Boulogne East. Yeah. Right. And then finally, Liz Williams was the great niece of Jack King and She was the only representative of Jack King's family. After we finished the tour, she explained to me how she was contacted by the author of that book, Toby, and also what the legacy of Jack means to her and her family. So I was asking you, wasn't I, about, yeah, you knew all about Jack then through your family?
My grandfather was Jack's brother.
Yes.
And he took over because Jack had the family farm, and my grandfather took it over.
Right.
The big hallway.
So Jack's your great uncle then?
My great uncle, yeah. Who I obviously never knew. I knew my grandfather up till I was five. He died when I was five.
Yeah.
But the family farm had a big hallway, all black walls.
Yeah.
Massive room it was. And it was lined with team photographs.
Oh, really?
Of England and all of different. Headingley played for and all sorts of things. So I always knew that there's a rugby connection.
Yes.
And my grandmother was very good. She'd never met Jack.
No.
She married sort of 3 or 4 years after he died. She married into the family. And
yes.
She told me a lot of things. Have all the memorabilia that the family have got.
Right. So just to summarise, as we wandered round, occurred to me that maybe the spirits of those lads, Jack and Noel, were still with us. A place that they wouldn't recognise now because it's so modern. But somewhere in those corridors and out on the pitch, they're still there in many ways. I'm sure they followed our tour around that historic ground 110 years to the day since they fell together on the battlefields of the Somme. As I said, during the tour, I'm sure they'd have been very proud to see incredibly 3 generations of their family there, remembering them. And most importantly, there were 4 youngsters. One, a young girl, Molly, who was just coming up to her 13th birthday. You heard from Jack, who took part in the Armistice Centenary 2018. There were 2 more teenage boys from the Slowcock family, Archie and Harry. They were all fully engaged in what we were doing. They were totally respectful of the stories that the tour guide David and Lewis and Toby explained to us. They will never forget their experience, I wouldn't have thought, at Twickenham on Sunday, the 9th of August 2026. I'm sure they'll carry the legacy of their relative into their adult life. And maybe one day they'll go to the Somme with their own children and grandchildren. And maybe they'll play this podcast to them. Who knows? We don't know what the future holds, do we? But I think the final words come from the back cover of Toby's book. He says that Jack and Noel came from vastly different backgrounds. One was an orphan when he was 13, and the other raised in a very well-to-do Victorian household, shaped by strong religious values. Yet their lives followed a strikingly similar path, grounded in deeply rooted principles, a commitment to family, a tireless work ethic, and the profound sense of duty to king and country. Both were gifted sportsmen, and it was the camaraderie forged on the rugby field that ultimately led to their tragic demise. That they will never be forgotten, will they? I was going to sound the last post this week because both died, but I'm not going to. Having discussed it with Toby, we chose this song to remember Noel and Jack, World in Union. It was first played at the 1991 World Cup in England, and it's now become the anthem of the Rugby World Cup. And that means it would have been played when Lewis won the World Cup in 2003. And it's that song that we shall hear this week being sung by Catherine Jenkins. Thank you very much for tuning in to another episode of the. Please do rate and review from wherever you download it from. But for now, let's hear the unmistakable voice of Catherine Jenkins.
Mm-hmm. dream.